we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
The less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO, in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, April the 29th, 2016. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by our co-host, Caroline Carnery.
Hi there.
Tomorrow, April 30th, is Save the Frogs Day, which was started by the founder of the Save the Frogs organization and movement, Dr. Carrie Krieger. It takes place worldwide on the last Saturday of every April, and tomorrow is the 8th annual Save the Frogs Day. So why do we need to save the frogs? Well, amphibians are the largest group of endangered animals on the planet, and Dr. Krieger will be on the show today to tell us about some of these threats and what we can do to help. Then we'll go from saving the frogs to saving the seals. Once again, it's seal hunting season here in Canada, an egregious act of cruelty that has been happening every spring for many, many years, and is an abomination to our country. We'll have Cheryl Fink from the International Fund for Animal Welfare back on the show today to give us an update on the Canadian seal hunt for 2016. That interview is coming up shortly, so please do stay tuned. So, last weekend was the third annual Veg Expo trade show here in Vancouver at the Vancouver Convention Center, which Caroline and I attended. And what did you think, Caroline?
I thought it was crazy fun and crazy busy. I guess the organizers were completely overwhelmed because they expected about 5,000 people to attend based on previous year's attendance. And about 10,000 people showed up.
Yeah, it was the gluten-free show all over again. This happened with the first ever gluten-free show several years ago, and they had just lineups and people couldn't get in. That's Veg Expo this year.
It's just incredible. So vendors, were lined up in the aisles, and they were giving away the tastiest vegan samples, ice cream, cheeses, energy bars, all manner of smoothie concoctions, protein powders, and chocolate were in abundance. And I went and sought out all the chocolate places.
I sought out the grilled cheese sandwiches, and Leslie hooked me up because it was at Vegan Supply, and you couldn't reach it. There was a mob of people wanting the grilled cheese.
Now, I have something to say about that. Now, yeah. I'm going to email the organizers, and I'm going to tell them not to put Vegan Supply and Nice Vice inside the front door.
Nice Spice being Vancouver's latest and greatest vegan ice cream shop that everyone's talking about. Yeah, I didn't get to try any. The lineup was way too long.
It's crazy. So they should be put at the farthest most point from the door, and there should be little footprints on the floor leading to the ice cream and leading to the grilled cheese sandwiches.
Yeah. Well, I have to say people were, the second time I went around, people were obediently lined up for their ice cream. But like I said, the lineup was just horrendous. So,
I didn't get any ice cream and I didn't get any grilled cheese sandwiches. And I'm only 5'1" and I had a really hard time in that. Yeah. I'm going to have really tall shoes next year.
So I know there was a lot of talk about this online. Some people were calling it a big debacle, like terribly organized. I think it was actually really well organized. Like, how could you predict? I've done events like this before. I used to help organize Earth Saves Taste of Health, which was it was like a Veg Expo, but way, way, way smaller. This was huge. It was at the convention center. Veganism is on the rise, I think. And I just don't know like how they were to predict that this would happen like in a year. I was there tabling last year with Liberation BC, and I can assure you it was like a normal environment, like just people walking up. You could talk to people. There weren't mobs.
Yeah, this is a real challenge, and I think they've clearly learned, I'm sure, from what happened Absolutely. This year. And it is the perfect storm. It is environmentalism coming together with health conscious people coming together with veganism, people who really care about animals and animal rights.
Yeah.
And this is the perfect storm. It really is, and it's just this vegan thing is trending, and I think next year they're going to need a bigger boat.
Oh, or I suggest to do it over 2 days next year.
Absolutely. And you and I checked out Drina Burton's talk, mm-hmm. and it was so excellent.
Yep.
And she was talking about, and this was people were standing around just trying to get a few words of what she was saying. And she's raised a family of five, or at least three kids herself and her vegan husband, on a plant-based diet. And she's got a bunch of cookbooks. But she talked about the basics of how to put a vegan kitchen together. And I thought that was really outstanding. A lot of people now get the why we need this. But it's how do we do it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think she gave really good tips. And we posted a picture of her on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, if people want to check that out. It was a really great talk. I would have to say, though, I would appreciate some talks that were on, say, the other issues pertaining to the vegan lifestyle, such mm-hmm. as animal rights issues.
Absolutely. That was one of the main comments I saw in people posting up in Vancouver vegans yeah. website saying, okay, well, the kind of the opposite of what I'm saying I want to see the how, but people were saying, well, let's talk about the why of it. So I think maybe we need because I only saw the one speaker, I don't know if there was a complete absence of that kind of thing, but that's hopefully everyone will take their suggestions and give them to the organizers.
Yeah, and I think from what the feedback I was seeing on the Veg Expo Facebook page is the organizers are definitely taking that feedback and they're receptive to it. So that's
for them.
Yeah, totally.
It's exciting, though, isn't it?
Oh, totally. Like, I just see this, like, the comment I wrote, because people are really, like, putting it down, saying, oh, it was terrible, just because of the crowds. Like, that's good. There's crowds.
I think it was disappointing for some people who came, I had tickets, you had tickets.
Yeah.
People came without tickets, and I saw that
in.
Line, and
some
it was out the door.
In.
Like, that that had to be 2 hours, and then I think they were turned away. So, that is disappointing when you're really excited mm-hmm. about something.
Well, something that's not disappointing to me is that International Respect for Chickens Month is coming up next month in a couple days, and International Respect for Chickens Day is May 4th. That's next week. So what do you have to say about that, Caroline?
Well, Allison, I challenge you to your best chicken. Come on, will you promise me?
Yeah. We both grew up with chickens, right? So we kind of know that familiar sound.
I think it's such a soothing sound.
I love it.
I do. And the sound that a mother chicken makes when she is hatching her eggs, that very soothing sound she makes. And apparently mother chickens, I've got some chicken facts here.
All right.
And mother chickens actually start teaching their baby chickens sounds when they're actually in their eggs.
Mm-hmm.
So it is said.
Yeah, they speak to them when they're in their shell. Yeah, I've heard that before.
So apparently chickens were domesticated about 8,000 years ago, and they all come from Gallus gallus, the red jungle fowl. And there's about 150 varieties of domestic chickens alive today. And the names are: a mature male chicken is called a rooster, a cock mm-hmm. or a roo. A female chicken is called a hen. A chick is a newly hatched chicken. An immature male chicken is called a cockerel, and an immature female chicken, a pullet. Now, a hen can live up to about 20 years.
I didn't know that.
20 years.
So our pet chicken Willie was gypped. She only lived for 2 years. That's
only
really
for
sad.
2 years.
Yeah.
Should I ask what happened?
Police dog moved onto our street. I was telling you earlier how she had I've talked about this on the show before. She had the reign of our street when she was growing up. She was very as free range as it gets. And so the local dogs and cats knew her. They kind of like kept their distance most of the time. Sometimes they would kind of like quasi try to attack her, but never really, because cats weren't really like in shape to attack a chicken, I guess you could say. And, you know, the dogs kind of stayed away for the most part. But then an unfamiliar dog moved on the street. So we only had it for 2 years.
And he didn't know the rules. That's really a shame.
Yeah, he didn't know the rules of the road with Willie the chicken. And I didn't know 20 years until you just told me now.
Oh, no,
so that's heartbreaking to me.
Well, okay. And of course, chickens in battery hen cages, you know, how you live a much, much, much shorter life. So these animals
are cut out of their lives.
It's horrible. Yeah. And chickens can recognize 100 individual faces, and they have REM sleep, just like us. And they're now, I found this so interesting. Chickens are able to comprehend when an item is taken away, it still exists. Now, a young human child is unable to understand that, apparently.
I've heard of that before. Amazing chicken facts. That's all we have time for.
Oh, no, I had one more important chicken fact.
Go for it if it's that important.
It is. The chicken is the closest living relative to the T-Rex dinosaur. And I listened
to
I listened to a whole show on CBC Radio on why birds survived.
Yeah.
Because they ate seeds, where T-Rexes ate animals that lived on plants. And when photosynthesis stopped because of all the dust in the air after the satellite hit, all those dinosaurs died. And birds, which are little tiny dinosaurs, actually survived because they could eat seeds. And seeds did not depend on photosynthesis.
Wow. Well, that's definitely something that you're not going to hear anywhere else except for on Animal Voices. So thanks for those chicken facts, Caroline.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Hello, darlings. Sean Treviel here for Fruit Salad. Join us every Thursday from 7 to 8 p.m. for community news and events, live performances and music, fantastic guests, and just general fabulousness that you'd find in a fruit salad. Support your community radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. There's nothing else like this in Vancouver or in the world. Listen in.
There is a worldwide event taking place on May 7th, so coming up next week. Animal rights advocates will be meeting in front of the Vancouver Aquarium, and there will be plenty of signs and megaphones for you to use. This is the Empty the Tank event. The event will take place at 11 o'clock until 1 o'clock. Pay parking is available, or you can take the bus to Stanley Park and walk to the aquarium from there. You can check out the Facebook page, Empty the Tanks Vancouver.
And you're going, right?
I am absolutely going.
I may go myself. I went 2 years ago. We had well over a couple hundred people there. And I think this is a critical time.
Yeah, we have to do it. It's not enough for us to sit around in our living rooms and after having watched that Gary Charbonneau's movie and grumble about it. No, we have to pick up signs and be there on hand.
And if you don't know why to protest the aquarium, please go to YouTube and watch the film Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered. It's free there.
And Gary Charbonneau, the creator of that documentary, will be in attendance, as well as Annalise Sorg, the director of No Whales in Captivity. And if you'd like to print your own poster, you can check out the Facebook page Van Aquafax for a multitude of clever images to print.
So later that day, there's an exciting event coming up that we're supporting here on Animal Voices. It's called Opening Hearts and Minds. It's being presented by Mercy for Animals. They are a national animal rights organization that you probably know about. So that's Saturday, May the 7th from 7 to 8 p.m. It's a talk by former undercover investigator Lindsay Wolf. So she's going to be giving a presentation, it's all free, about the power of undercover investigations to change the world for animals. It's happening at the library downtown, 7 to 8 p.m. on Saturday, May the 7th.
And on May 21st and 22nd, Animal Advocacy Camp is returning to Vancouver. And the AAC aims to strengthen the animal advocacy movement by building empowered and passionate communities of animal advocates to end injustices perpetrated against other animals. You can get your tickets through www.eventbrite.com. www.fruitsandfruit.ca, and this will be my first time going. I can't wait.
Yeah, this will be, I've been to, I think we've had three or four of them now. I'm not sure. I've helped organize every one, and I'm organizing the food for this one. So with your ticket, we should say, which is only, I think it's $60 for the weekend and $35 per day if you're just going for one day, you get all your food included. So you're basically, you know, it's barely anything that you're paying for. And we have a whole range of speakers that are coming. You can check out the website at animaladvocacycamp2016.weebly.com to find out more about that. So, yeah, I'm excited you're going to be there, Caroline, because you'll love it. It's a great event where we can all converge together. That is, anyone who cares about animals, who wants to act on behalf of animals, or just to be inspired to do so. And we all come together and network and learn a lot. Lots of great speakers. If you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
For our first interview, we have Dr. Kerry Krieger on the show, a conservation biologist. He is the founder and executive director of Save the Frogs, the world's leading amphibian conservation organization. He conceived and coordinates Save the Frogs Day, the world's largest day of amphibian education and conservation action, which is tomorrow, April 30th. And he has given over 300 presentations on amphibian conservation all over the world. Today he is here to speak to us about frogs and why we need to save them. Hello, Dr. Krieger, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today to speak to us about frog and amphibian conservation issues. I don't think we've ever actually done a show before about amphibians, so I'm happy to have you here to educate us. First of all, could you give us a bit of a history about frogs? How long have they been on our Earth? Where do they live in the world, and how many species are there? I personally never see frogs here in Vancouver, although I'm sure we have them, but they are a bit of a mystery to me.
Frogs have been around in more or less their current form for hundreds of millions of years. They crawled out of the primordial swamps about 360 million years ago, to the best of our knowledge. And they have expanded and taken over most of the planet. They're on every continent except for Antarctica. And you will find frogs wherever there are wet places with fresh water. They don't live in salt water. And if you go to streams, swamps, ponds, rivers, you have a high chance of finding frogs. And they can't even live in places like deserts where there is no standing water, or at least it won't be permanent water. What'll happen is they can burrow underground and wait until it rains, and then they'll come up and have a breeding frenzy, perhaps for a few days, and then they may go back underground. So the time to find frogs almost everywhere is when it's the rainy season.
So I'm curious about amphibians as well. I know that a frog is a type of amphibian. And when I was doing my research for this interview, I discovered there are some amphibians I didn't know about. So what is the definition of an amphibian, and what kinds of varieties are there?
Okay. Yeah, there's about 7,000 different amphibian species that we know of. Most of these, about 6,000, are frogs and toads. And then there are also salamanders and newts. And then the fifth type of amphibian most people don't know about, I've actually never seen one. It's called a Sicilian. And they live in Central and South America, Africa, and Southeast Asia. They're very hard to find because they're not out calling and because they live underground. So you have to be pretty lucky to find a Sicilian, or else you have to be prepared to dig a lot and turn over a lot of dirt. But yeah, in Vancouver, you have Pacific chorus frogs, and that's one of the most common frogs up and down the Pacific coast of North America. There are lots of frogs. They'll adapt to their surroundings, so they look very different in various places. And you'll find frogs in the rainforest and even up high in mountains at, say, 12,000 feet, you can find frogs. Yeah, there's actually salamanders living up in the North Cascades at very high altitudes. So amphibians are really amazing creatures that adapt to their surroundings.
So can you talk about the role that frogs play in our ecosystems and the history, I understand, of dwindling numbers of species from many years ago until now?
Yeah, amphibians are the most rapidly disappearing group of vertebrates on the planet. And they've been around, as I said, for hundreds of millions of years. They have survived countless ice ages and asteroid crashes and outlived the dinosaurs. So it's pretty amazing that in the last 50 years or so, about a third of the world's amphibian species have been driven to the edge of extinction. They're having a lot of trouble because there's habitat destruction, people destroy land, and pesticide use, pollution gets into the water where the frogs are living and breeding. There's infectious diseases that are being spread around the world because humans ship about 100 million amphibians around the world each year for commerce. This is for pets and for bait and for food. Laboratories use frogs. And when you ship frogs around the world, some of them are inevitably sick. And currently there's some pretty bad infectious diseases of frogs, skin diseases called chytridiomycosis. And this disease spreads when people ship frogs around, and a sick frog will get released into the wild and infect native populations. So a lot of frogs, especially in cool places like British Columbia, cool, moist places, those frogs have a lot of trouble with this disease. And as frogs disappear, it's a problem because frogs are very important in the ecosystem. They're eating ticks, flies, mosquitoes, and pest species that we don't want and that spread diseases to humans. And amphibians serve as food for birds, fish, snakes. Lots of animals depend on frogs. If frogs disappear, then it has effects throughout the food chain. And we also have derived lots of medical advances from frogs being around. About 10% of the Nobel Prizes in Physiology and Medicine have gone to researchers whose work depended on frogs. And frogs are really cool. People like frogs and provide us with entertainment and enjoyment and reconnect us with the natural world. So there's a lot of reasons to save the frogs.
Well, one interesting thing that I learned on your website is that frogs actually serve as bioindicators because they have permeable skin. Can you talk about that and what we can learn from the actual harm that frogs have endured as a result of human usage of our planet?
Yeah, amphibians are really neat because they have permeable skin. That's different than our skin. Our skin is meant to keep things out, to protect us, but amphibians can drink and breathe through their skin. And this is important because it means if there's bad chemicals in the water, then they're going to go right inside of the frog really easily. So pollutants, pesticides, gravity brings all of these bad chemicals down to the water. And we've got about 1 billion pounds of pesticide being used around the world each year. If you go to any flat area of the planet, it's probably being farmed unless it's a desert. And most conventional farming these days is heavily dependent on pesticides. So a lot of amphibians basically get poisoned by all of these bad chemicals, in part because they have permeable skin.
So I'm wondering maybe if you can touch upon how many frogs did we start out with, that is species, and how quickly are they dwindling? Like how many species of frogs have we lost to date because of all these threats to frogs that you've been speaking about?
Yeah, as I said, about 7,000 amphibian species we know of. At least 2,000 are threatened with extinction, endangered. The true number is probably higher than that. It's just that there's at least 1,000 species around the world that we don't know much about what's happening to their populations, in large part because their populations are so small that they're difficult to study and research. And if you have a small population, then you are prone to extinction. So, well, in all likelihood, it's over 2,000 species that are on the verge of extinction. And about 200 species have already gone completely extinct in the last few decades. If we look at the fossil record, then we can see that frogs naturally go extinct at about one species every 500 years. So currently, they're disappearing several thousand times faster than is natural. So this should serve as an alarm call to anybody who cares about having a healthy planet. Frogs are so important in our ecosystems, and they keep water clean. And as we talked about before, they're bioindicators. If frogs are disappearing, then it's saying something is wrong in the environment.
Well, the 8th annual Save the Frogs Day happens tomorrow on April 30th. Can you please tell us about this day, which you found it, and how it has achieved the goal to educate people and get them active about frogs? And I'm curious to know about some of the actions that you've been involved with to conserve frog species around the world.
Yeah, Save the Frogs Day was one of the first projects that I started when I founded Save the Frogs in 2008. And since that time, we've had 1,050 known events, educational events, take place around the world in about 60 different countries for Save the Frogs Day. This Save the Frogs Day, we expect about 150 events in 25 countries to take place. And most of this is our volunteers around the world take action by holding an educational event of some sort, or perhaps habitat restoration, something conservation focused, to inform their communities about the importance of amphibians. So Save the Frogs Day has been really incredible about in getting people involved and giving people the ability to do something beneficial for the environment in their part of the world. And yeah, Save the Frogs Day, we encourage everybody to go to savethefrogs.com/day. That's the official webpage of Save the Frogs Day. And you can find out where events are taking place around the world, and you can find out how you can hold an event yourself. It's every April, the last Saturday of April is Save the Frogs Day. So if you're just hearing about it now, then you can plan for the last April of 2017. And on our website, savethefrogs.com, we also have a page dedicated to ways to help frogs, the How to Help page, with over 50 ways people can get involved. And we do a lot more than just Save the Frogs Day. We've protected land. The city of San Francisco was planning to destroy some frog habitat last year, and we got them to stop that project. In Lake Erie in eastern Canada, a apartment building was scheduled to be built on top of Fowler's toad habitat. There's only 3 total populations of Fowler's toad remaining in Canada. We held a Save the Frogs Academy class focused on protecting that Fowler's toad population, and we got the developers to cancel that project. We have also gotten laws in place to prevent the introduction of non-native bullfrogs. Bullfrogs are a problem in about 15 countries, including the American West and in British Columbia. Bullfrogs, American bullfrogs, are native to the eastern USA and Canada. They're the number one frog that's farmed for food, so they're shipped all around the world primarily for food. They escape. They are the largest frog in North America. They have a very large mouth, and they like to eat native frogs. And they have high levels of the amphibian disease chytridiomycosis, which they spread in native populations. We've gotten laws in place to prevent that. We also have chapters all around the world. This September, we're leading a expedition to Ghana in West Africa, where we have an office in Kumasi, Ghana, and a lot of programs for critically endangered West African frogs. In West Africa, about 90% of the rainforests have been destroyed, and there's a huge need for environmental education and conservation. So we'll be going there with about 18 amphibian experts and frog enthusiasts, and we're going to be giving presentations in schools, training university students, restoring habitat, and working to protect some of the endangered frogs there.
That's a lot of work that you are doing, and it really seems like such a huge amount of effort is needed because these issues face frogs all over the world. You do say that a significant amount of effort will be required to alleviate the current threats to amphibians, which will require scientists, lawyers, educators, media, and an informed public. How do you see this all progressing to form an effective coalition that will create change, and what can our listeners do to save the frogs?
Yeah, I think there's been huge progress. I started Save the Frogs, it was just me, just one person who had a vision of accomplishing a lot specifically for frogs. I spent 4 years in Australia doing my PhD research on endangered amphibians, and the problem that I saw was that most of the amphibian work was just in the sciences, and I knew that it needed to involve politicians and the public, especially getting educated people and ensuring that the next generation of humans was intelligent and cared about amphibians and the environment and had the tools to protect the environment. So currently we've got chapters all around the world. We've got volunteers all around the world. Save the Frogs Day tomorrow, in about 25 countries. So it's come a long way. And part of the reason is because Save the Frogs provides so many free educational resources to people. If they go to savethefrogs.com and they can download all types of flyers that they can post around their community. We've got about 60 videos up on our YouTube channel that basically is talking about all types of ways that they can help frogs. So yeah, I suggest people go to the How to Help page and learn a lot about ways to help frogs. Some of the simple ways are just improving your own ecological footprint, reducing, reusing, recycling, use rechargeable batteries. Batteries have tons of bad chemicals in them, so there's no point in going through lots of batteries since we don't need to anymore. People can eat less meat. The number one cause of deforestation of the Amazon rainforest is chopping down forests to raise cattle. Definitely go organic. Don't use pesticides in your backyard or in your garden. Don't eat frog legs. Don't purchase wild-caught amphibians as pets. If your local school is dissecting frogs, then talk to your teacher and get them to stop. We have a page all about dissections, and we do offer free digital dissection software. Schools give up their dissection program. Also, slow down driving on wet nights because there's a lot of frogs on the road. Never stock non-native fish or pond in your streams. Stop drinking so much bottled water because all that plastic is horrible for the environment. Turn off the tap and, in general, conserve resources. Those are ways people can improve their ecological footprint. There's also lots of ways that people could help out Save the Frogs organization. I definitely encourage people to go to our website, savethefrogs.com, sign up for our newsletter, that we can stay in touch. Please become a member. We're about to start something called the Save the Frogs Academy 90-Day Challenge, and we're going to be meeting online every week and giving people a lot of info about a certain amphibian conservation topic and then giving them a challenge. So it'll be about 1 hour a week online and then 2 hours a week where people will go out and do something beneficial for amphibians that they will also learn a lot from. So I encourage people to take the Save the Frogs Academy 90-Day Challenge. And in general, let's just stay connected. We've got social media sites, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, all of those at Save the Frogs.
Well, that's certainly not a lack of things that people can do to get active for their frogs, especially for Save the Frogs Day tomorrow. That's April 30th. Thank you for coming on the show today, Dr. Krieger, to speak about frog conservation and advocacy. For more information, please visit the website at savethefrogs.com. Thanks for all the great work you're doing.
Thank you so much for spreading the word about amphibians.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
Today's feature interview is with Cheryl Fink. As the Wildlife Campaigns Director of IFAW Canada, the International Fund for Animal Welfare, her primary focus is to end the commercial seal hunt in Canada. Cheryl has observed the commercial seal hunt now for 12 years in Canada, and she's been documenting the hunt from the air and on the ice to provide ongoing evidence of its cruelty and wastefulness. She has given testimony around the world, lobbied politicians, and appeared on TV. Cheryl, welcome to Animal Voices. Thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the program.
Okay. We've got a lot of questions to get through today, so I'm going to start right in. The Canadian non-Aboriginal seal hunt on the Atlantic coast is the largest slaughter of marine mammals on Earth. The seal hunt happens in Newfoundland and Labrador, and the quotas of the hunt last year, and I think these were repeated this year, but please correct me if I'm wrong, were 400,000 harp seals, 60,000 gray seals, 8,200 hooded seals. But before going forward on this topic, let's take a historic look at the seal hunt in Atlantic Canada. Can you give us a brief historical perspective of how the seal hunt has arisen in Canada history, how it has evolved over the last 500 years, and exactly what is the difference between the Aboriginal and the non-Aboriginal seal hunts? Because your campaign is targeted just at the on the non-Aboriginal commercial seal hunt.
Sure. And I'll try to do 500 years of history relatively quickly.
Yeah, in 30 seconds or so.
Primarily, when we're talking about the East Coast seal hunt, it started off, as you said, you know, back in the 16, 1700s with fishermen and landsmen killing seals for their oil, which was sent back to Europe, where it was used for lighting, for cooking, for lubrication, and to process things like leather. It was primarily a hunt for the blubber. And the hunt, you know, continued to grow. We had the advent of technology. Bigger boats were involved. And the golden age of sealing really happened between 1818 and 1862. Over 18 million seals were killed during that period, which
wow.
is a phenomenal number.
Yeah, incomprehensible, really.
Huge, yeah. huge. And, of course, we'll get to this later, but a lot of tragedy also happened during that period. Mm-hmm. Boats lost in the ice. And, you know, it continued up until the 1930s. The Norwegian sealing industry, having depleted the seals over on the eastern Atlantic, had discovered our seal patches over here and had made it over to the western side and began to take over the sealing industry. And that's sort of where things started to change around 1940, 1950. The Norwegians had the technology to tan, to process seal skins and to use them for their fur. So the hunt really shifted from being for blubber, which was no longer needed now that we had electricity, to being a hunt for fur to use to make, you know, fashion and luxury garments. And that's really the main purpose of the commercial hunt, or the East Coast hunt, as it is today. And talking about, you know, the difference between the two hunts, the East Coast hunt or the commercial hunt, and the Inuit seal hunt, that is the main difference. Inuit hunt seals primarily for meat. It's very much a subsistence hunt. There is some secondary sale of sealskin products that are derived from that hunt, but it's primarily still a hunt for meat, for consumption, whereas the East Coast hunt is a hunt for fur. We see most of the meat discarded. A little bit is used and consumed locally, but by and large, most of the meat is being wasted on the ice, which is something that wouldn't be tolerated in, you know, any other sort of hunting that we sort of think of or this day and age. There's other differences. The East Coast hunt is very competitive. It targets the young pups of the year, pups under 3 months of age. So there's a sort of a rush to get them before they start to enter the water and learn how to swim, or the ice breaks up and the seals start migrating northward. It's very competitive, very fast-paced, and it's the hunt that's going on right now on the East Coast of Canada.
And it started April 10th, I believe. And when does it go until?
The last couple of years, I think the department has officially left it open all year round. But
I didn't know that.
In practice, the harp seals are a migratory species, so they will start migrating northwards in the summertime for their summer feeding grounds.
Okay.
So come usually about middle of May, they'll be out of range of the sealers. So that's why we say that, like, most of the seals are under 3 months old by the time they're killed, because by that time they've moved far enough northward that they're out of range of the seal hunt.
Okay. So let's fast forward to 2016. The seal hunt continues. We've all seen the graphic photos and the videos of the brutality, or many of us have. And of course, it leaves us wondering, many of us, why is this still happening today? In your recent Huffington Post article, you noted, and I quote, "The seal hunt is an issue protected by intimidation and politics and driven by fear." Okay, so tell us, who is intimidated by what, and where is the fear emanating from?
I think, and this is what's gotten me most interested in the seal hunt, and when I first got involved, is that the seal hunt isn't about jobs or economics or making a living anymore. It's really been driven by the politics and by Ottawa, and this idea that federal politicians can stand up and defend the seal hunt and protect the seal hunt. And it's politically very expedient for them, profitable for them, because it makes it look like they're doing something for Atlantic Canada, and really they're not doing that much. They're not actually helping people to improve their livelihoods or to make an economic difference in communities. I think that's sort of what's driving the thing nowadays. I find it fascinating. And the intimidation, we've got the fur institute, or the fur industry, which is very powerful, very wealthy, and politicians, and people perpetuating this idea that we can't do any better than clubbing seals to make a living, that there are no other opportunities in these communities. And I think that's doing, you know, a great disservice to a lot of people to say that this is the only option. And the fear, I think fear is real. Going to Newfoundland, you know, every season we're out there, people were afraid of losing their culture, their identity. The seal hunt is something that's sort of symbolic a part of Newfoundland's history and their way of life. And to see the seal hunt in decline and see the seal hunt disappearing, I think for a lot of people that's losing a part of their history and a part of their past. A lot of other people sort of are like, well, we don't need seal fur anymore, and no one really eats it anyways, and good riddance. People, not everyone feels that way, but I think symbolically for a lot of people there's fear. And there's also fear we hear from people who are questioning the hunt and are concerned, you know, about their taxes being used to continue it, particularly with the economic situation there now. They fear that they can't speak out against the hunt, and that anyone who questions the hunt or talks about the hunt, or, you know, questions why are we doing it, why are we still supporting it, is very likely to get bullied or harassed, or, you know, some people even are afraid of losing their jobs. There's such a culture of protection of the industry out there. So a lot of real challenges.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would think that to be on the ground there and to be speaking up and out about this would, you know, really lead to legitimate fear of what could happen to, you know, your property being vandalized or you personally being roughed up. And yeah, it's difficult. It's much easier for us on the West Coast all the way over here to have a chat about it than to be on the ground there speaking up and out. Now, in the same article that I've just quoted, you say that, and I quote, "The fact that the seal hunt was and continues to be a story of human tragedy, worker exploitation, and tragic loss of life at sea is lost in a sepia-toned haze of nostalgia." Now, this is a side of the hunt that we don't hear much about. Can you please describe to us what you believe the human tolls are operating in the hunt?
Yeah, historically, the human tolls have been, you know, devastating at the seal hunt. There's been a few major disasters. The 1914 Great Sealing Disaster, where 132 men were stranded on the ice for 2 days and 78 died. At the same season, another vessel exploded, and huge death tolls from that one as well. I mean, and aside from the death, I mean, there's it's hard work, it's dirty work, it doesn't pay well. Historically, sealers were very exploited by boat captains. It was a horrible way to try and make money, but it's something now that's sort of romanticized. And I think it's important to remember the lives that were lost and the hardships that happened at the seal hunt. And on the other hand, I don't think it's something that we really need to keep continuing either.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that long ago, just a few years ago, where we had a boat go down and many people were killed.
That's right. I think it was 7-8 years ago now. There were 4 lives lost in the Gulf of St. Lawrence as a result of an accident. And, you know, tragic. We've been pushing on the government to put into place the safety recommendations made by the Transportation Safety Board in the wake of that incident. What they found was that most of the boats out at the seal hunt are not equipped to be operating in ice. They're not reinforced. They're not suited for that kind of activity. They're just regular fishing boats. You know, 8 years later, the government still hasn't made these changes to the regulations to make the hunt safer. So, you know, fortunately, we haven't had lives lost in recent years, but it's bound to happen again, and I think it should be a concern to everyone.
Of course. Now, I've watched your video aimed at raising awareness and urging the government to stop the hunt, and you focus, I would say, on 3 main points. There's the cruelty factor, the fact that it's unnecessary in your opinion, and the wastefulness of the hunt itself. And you alluded to this earlier, but I wanted to come back to it because I think I heard you say that 90% of the animal is simply left on the ice to rot. And then it seems like the world increasingly seems to be saying no to Canadian seal fur products, given that 35 countries now have banned the import of these products. So I have a few questions for you around this. First of all, where is the 90% number coming from? What are you basing that on?
The 90% waste we've actually had to calculate based on numbers that we've gotten from Fisheries and Oceans. What we did, and we have data for 2014, I think is the most recent year. They didn't release it last year, which was another issue why they're not releasing the data.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But what we did is we looked at the number of pelts that were reported landed, or the number of skins that were brought in, and then we looked at the amount of meat that was brought in. Now, then we calculated how much meat would be on an individual animal, keeping in mind that these are, you know, 3-week to 3-month-old animals. They're relatively small. There's not a huge amount of meat on a seal of that age because it's a hunt for fur. But we calculated, I think it was about 5 kilograms of potential meat that could be used per seal. And then when we took that and compared it to the number of skins that were landed, which would be the number of animals actually killed, mm-hmm. we found that actually less than 10% of the usable meat was being brought in, meaning over 90% of the seals were killed and only their fur was taken, sort of high grading just for the skins. Which again, you can't do that with any other hunt. You can't hunt a walrus for the Inuit that hunt walrus and just leave the meat to waste on the ice, or you can't hunt a deer or a moose and just leave the meat to rot in the forest. But it's something that seems to be, it's the norm when it comes to the commercial seal hunt.
And yeah, and I'm just wondering how the whole thing holds together economically in light of this. I know that you've indicated that you think the animal is dying. So much of the actual animal is being left behind. So how does the whole thing hang together in your opinion?
Not very well when you look at it. Economically, it's clear that the industry continues to rely on government support from both the provincial and federal governments. There was a report last month saying that the federal government spends $2.5 million a year alone just sort of monitoring the hunters, like keeping the infrastructure in place for it to go ahead. And the reported landed value of the hunt last year was only $1.1 million. It's usually about $1 to $2 million in recent years that the hunt's actually bringing in. And we have $5-10 million that are going to the hunt in loans, in grants, in marketing promotion, and all kinds of funding that's being used to try to keep the seal hunt alive, to try to open up international markets for seal products, to try to fight the European ban at the World Trade Organization, which failed. You know, a lot of money is being spent to try and keep this industry alive. It's not bringing that economic in back into the communities or back into the province at all. So again, it's politically advantageous for politicians to support this, but the people on the ground aren't benefiting from it. It's not fishermen who are seeing this money at the end of the day.
Well, the fact that the federal government is funding the seal hunt, the several million dollars a year, as you're saying, it's quite surprising. This means that all of us Canadians are paying for this slaughter to happen with our tax dollars. Your organization and countless other animal welfare organizations have petitioned the federal government year after year to end the hunt, and year after year, the hunt continues. So I'm curious to know what Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is saying all about it. He himself has been photographed with his family looking all proud and happy wearing seal pelts. So it doesn't sound like a glowing picture of receptivity. Have you had a response from him on this?
Not from Prime Minister Trudeau himself, but as you say, he's, you know, photographed wearing sealskin vests and eating seal meat at events and wrapped in coyote furs and all the rest of it. So not very encouraging. We did receive a response from Fisheries Minister Tutu, who refused to meet with us, saying that he understood our position and knew our position on the seal hunt and didn't feel that they needed to meet with us.
Wow.
And he reaffirmed his support for both the Inuit seal hunt and the commercial seal hunt, which is something we've been trying to really, as I said, make a distinction between the two industries. Our previous government was insistent on merging the two together and presenting them as though they were one activity. That might have been a strategy to try to prevent the European ban, but it failed. And I think it's important to distinguish that these are two very separate activities. We don't talk about fishing as one whole thing. There's different types of fisheries and different purposes of fishing and different species of fish. So we shouldn't be talking about sealing as one activity either. We need to talk about it as a separate commercial hunt and the Inuit hunt. But yeah, unfortunately, for a government that promised real change, they seem very intent on supporting the status quo when it comes to the seal hunt.
It seems like that fear thing is alive and well, for sure. Now, in the video, in addition to the video, you've got a new appeal going forward in the form of a petition, and you're encouraging the government to buy out the hunting license of the sealers. Tell us more about that idea, and how do you respond to people who defend the hunt, saying that people desperately need these jobs and that you're destroying their livelihood and culture and traditions?
Well, the idea of a buyout is that if this hunt is going to die. I mean, it's dying on its own. We see the markets disappearing. You know, I don't want to be overconfident, obviously, but for all intents and purposes, I think the commercial seal hunt is going to go the same way as commercial whaling did back in the 70s. It's not products we need. People are increasingly concerned about the welfare of the animals, and there's got to be better options. So what we're saying is take the money, and instead of trying to keep the seal hunt alive, which we've seen tens of millions of dollars wasted on this in the past two decades, use that to buy back the licenses, compensate those who have been making a little bit of money from it each year, and but do more than that. Put money into these communities to help provide real jobs, real opportunities. I know we can do better than encouraging people and forcing people to go out and club seals for a few weeks of the year to try to make money. There has to be better opportunities than that. So that's really where we're pushing the government, is to take, you know, stop the subsidies that are supporting the hunt and use those to provide real change and real support for communities.
Okay, good. Now, I've taken a look at the commentary to your article in the Huffington Post, and there were some angry comments there. You were called a racist.
Try not to read them.
I'm sorry.
Never read the comments.
Well, people get really, I know you were called honey, and believe me, the tone was not one of endearment. But I've taken a couple of comments from that thread, and I just wanted to raise them quickly with you as our time is winding down. It says, Fink and the likes are protecting nothing but their job, which is to lie about the seal hunt and sealers. Markets are plentiful for animal proteins, omega-3 and fur. Despite all their efforts to destroy people's democratic rights to choose seal products in 35 countries, there are still over 150 countries open to trade in those natural, sustainable, renewable, free-range, hormone and antibiotic-free products. Activists are trying hard to destroy the marine ecosystem, but coastal communities will not have it and will fight for the right to sustainably use their natural resources and keep their environment healthy. Okay, so let's talk about this.
First of all, if it's the same Jill, I think Jill is also the head of the Magdalen Island Sealers Association.
Oh, okay. Well, that gives a little perspective.
Maybe it might give us some context. but I think, the assertion that markets are plentiful for seal products is completely not supported by the facts. If there were markets, we wouldn't have seen the hunt decline by 90% since 2009. The seal hunt last year was at its lowest recorded kill level ever, in recent history anyways, which is incredible. And what we're seeing is that there aren't markets for seal products, and the markets that do exist are only there because of the continued government effort to prop them up and to find markets and to promote them. I mean, we're putting so much money into trying to create these markets. It's a bit of an illusion, really. These markets don't seem to actually exist at the end of the day, which is why the kill numbers have gone down so much, which is fantastic, really, from our perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the idea that we're trying to destroy the marine ecosystem, that's exceptionally hilarious. I think, we've heard this too, that if we need to harvest seals, we need to manage the environment, when history has shown that, in fact, we're pretty wretched when it comes to trying to do anything involving our environment and managing it, and it can take care of itself quite well.
Well, and one of the people says here specifically, if we don't hunt these seals, we're going to be looking at a cull in 5 years, like in other nations. And we've just got a couple more minutes left here.
We don't need to cull seals. There is absolutely no scientific evidence that seals are preventing cod stock recovery, either through competition or predation. So, there's no science to support it. I know there's a very strong belief that seals are eating all the fish, but nothing to support it. So why would we need to cull seals? Seals are doing fine on their own. Climate change, unfortunately, is starting to have a negative impact. I think we've seen perhaps small declines in the population, and the reproductive rates of harp seals have been dropping in recent years. So I think the seals will be fine on their own. They certainly don't need us to be out there slaughtering them for any reason.
Mm-hmm. And for the animal rights advocates at home, listening at home, what are the top actions we can take today to end this slaughter?
I would say contact your member of parliament. Let them know that you're a voter in their riding and that you oppose the seal hunt and you don't want to see your taxes wasted on it. I mean, we're really pushing actions right now. Obviously, not buying seal products and informing others about the seal hunt and the cruelty, that's also very important. But I think, calling your member of parliament, emailing your member of parliament, writing them a handwritten letter, let them know that you're opposed to the hunt. I think that's the best way to get the message back up to Ottawa.
Yes, and I've written my letter and I'll be sending that off this afternoon, and I'll be going to your site in order to sign that and share that on Facebook. And I just wanted to say thank you, Cheryl, for shedding light on the issue of the annual Canadian seal slaughter. And to find out more about the campaign and to sign the petition that we're talking about here today to the federal government, go to www.ifaw.org/seals.
Thank you, Cheryl, for joining us on the show today, and good luck in your fight against the seal hunt.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having the issue on. It's so important that people still remember that it's going on, even though it's not as big as it used to be. It's fantastic.
Great. Thanks. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM, CFRO, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show next Friday, May the 6th, to celebrate Mother's Day next weekend. We'll be sharing a trio of interviews with three vegan mothers to speak on their experiences of being vegan mothers. Plus, we'll have a special in-depth interview with former Mercy for Animals investigator Lindsay Wolf. She'll be sharing with us her activist story and what it was like to go undercover to expose cruelty in the animal agriculture system. I'm really looking forward to that one. How about you, Caroline?
Well, you know how I feel about this is some people have celebrity worship and I have animal abuse investigator worship. I think the world of them, and I can't wait to put some questions to Lindsay next week and just to be in the same room with her and hear about her experiences and stories.
Yeah, I'm so glad we'll be able to have her here and to also share the stories of all the mothers as well, because that's something that I think is we haven't done on the show before. So looking forward to that. So we here at Animal Voices, we want to connect with you online. You can go to our website, animalvoices.org, and there you can listen to our past podcasts and you can stream them or download them. You can also subscribe to us via iTunes. We are on iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. You can join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And finally, you can send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. So we're closing the show now with music for International Respect for Chickens Day. That's happening on May 4th, and all of May is an International Respect for Chickens Month. So this piece, it's a piece by my band, the 15th Field Band, and it's the main title from the film Chicken Run. Stay tuned now for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today. And remember to be kind to the animals.